That's why I didn't go away on that weekend, see? So I can be all alone up there and sit down on my typewriter. This time I'm going to do it, Nat. I'm going to do it.
Maybe you will.
Thank you, Nat. Am I all paid up?
Yes, Mr. Blaine.
Goodbye, Nat. I'm going home. This time I've got it. I'm going to write.
That's Ray Milland, and he's playing an alcoholic writer named Don Burnham in Billy Wilder's 1945 film, The Lost Weekend, one of the first movies to confront the devastating effects of alcoholism.
My name is Charles Jackson, and I'm an alcoholic. My story isn't much different from other people's. It's the story of a man who is made a fool of by alcohol over and over and over, year after year after year, until finally the day came when I learned that I could not handle this alone.
Now, I'm a big Billy Wilder fan, and I've seen this movie 4 times, but for whatever reason, I never thought to read the Charles Jackson novel that the movie was based on, until earlier this year, when Knopf sent me a package containing Blake Bailey's latest book, Farther and Wilder, a biography of Jackson, along with 2 new paperback editions of The Lost Weekend, and a short story collection called The Sunnier Side. Now, the idea here was for Blake Bailey to appear on this program. There was just one problem with this. I received this package about 1.5 weeks before Blake was set to be in New York, so there was no way for me to read the books and interview him in time. So, time passed, and then one Saturday morning, I decided to read The Lost Weekend, and I read it in one sitting. I could not put this down. The book was a true masterpiece, possibly more unsettling than the film that emerged from it. It chronicled every painful nicety of addiction. It was published in 1944, so it was ahead of its time in writing about repressed homosexuality, and it captures a New York that no longer exists. It's got a gritty feel, and I urge you to pick up The Lost Weekend and read it at the earliest opportunity. It is magnificent. So, let me tell you how good The Lost Weekend is. It was so good that I swiftly obtained all of the other Charles Jackson books, and I read them all. And then I read Blake's biography. And then there was the issue of what to do. I mean, given all this reading, surely I had to talk with Blake Bailey. So Blake and I corresponded over a few months, and we finally figured out a time to chat. There was just one additional monkey wrench. You see, Blake had yet another book coming out, a memoir called The Splendid Things We Planned that will be published by Norton in March. So I contacted the good folks at Norton, they hooked me up with a galley, and I read that too. It turns out that Blake Bailey and I may be the only 2 people in America who have actually read everything that Charles Jackson has published. So the conversation you are about to hear, which works in every single book I have just mentioned, represents one of the most reading-heavy talks this program has ever aired, but I think it is very fun, so enjoy.
Okay, so I am here, once again, with Blake Bailey, who is most recently the author of Farther and Wilder. Blake, how are you doing?
I'm good. It's great to be here, Ed.
Yes, so I've basically surprised you by pointing to the fact that I think you and I may be one of the few people in America, or among the few people who have actually read all of Charles Jackson's work.
Ed, probably the only two. His own daughters, who are alive and well,
have not read the of
Charles Jackson.
Wow.
No, it's you and me.
That's it, wow. So, let's talk. I mean,
yeah, absolutely.
So, Charles Jackson, best known as the author of The Lost Weekend, but let's get into what he did. I mean, he was adamantly determined in his early days to write what he knew, as you outline in your biography of him. Don Burnham, the protagonist of The Lost Weekend, many of Jackson's short stories, and also the hero of this unfinished multi-volume book project, What Happened? This is basically the Jackson's life. This is what Jackson drew heavily on for his fiction. But then you have Jackson's later fiction, The Outer Edges, A Secondhand Life, and The Outlander, which I'm happy to argue with you about. I mean, these are adamantly determined to suggest deviance or behavioral aberration in sort of common everyday human fallacies, often out of step with the cultural mores at the time. So then, of course, you have The Sunnier Side, this story, in which Charles Jackson himself appears and is commenting upon various people in Newark. So just to get started here, and that's a lot to talk about, why do you think Jackson was so terrified of his own life and fiction, so willing to castigate himself? Why did he need to pit his real and his fictional selves against each other and against society?
Well, it's interesting. You mentioned Newark, and I want to clarify for your listeners, that is not Newark, New Jersey, the hometown of yes. my current subject, Philip Roth. That is Newark, New York, in the yes. township of Arcadia, up in the Finger Lakes region of upstate New York. It was a little town of about 6,000 souls where Charles Jackson led a very tortured childhood and idyllic childhood. It was a little of both. Beautiful region. And people are kind to you in a sort of condescending way there. Charlie and his brother Fred, known always throughout his adult life as Boom,
yeah.
were the town sissies.
There's also a beefcake shot of Boom in the book as well.
A gorgeous beefcake shot of yeah. Boom, taken by the famous gay photographer George Platt Lines. There are photos by Man Ray
yeah.
of Boom at the Hood Library. I mean, the Hood Museum at Dartmouth. Anyway, so Charlie kind of deplored the way that people gossip maliciously in small towns such as Newark and yet, you know, put a good face on things. And when the worst catastrophes happened, for example, Charlie was molested by the choir master of his church, a man named Herbert Quance, who appears in his first published story, in Charlie's first published story, Palm Sunday, which was a pioneering work. It appeared in Partisan Review in 1939, and nobody was writing about, you know, pedophilia.
Yeah.
It's quite frank
yeah.
in its treatment of that. It's a terrific story, and it caused as much of a ripple at Partisan Review as Delmore Schwartz's in Dreams Begin Responsibilities. So anyway, you know, he was molested at age 14. The year before, his sister Thelma, his 16-year-old sister Thelma, and 4-year-old brother Richard were killed by a train. And sort of the egregious, phony kindness with which he was treated. And meanwhile, people knew about this pedophiliac choir master, but nice people didn't talk about that sort of thing. You didn't talk about, you know, touching little boys and whatnot. So he was tolerated, and even though they knew that their own children were in danger of being molested. So, long story short, Charlie regarded this as a deplorable state of affairs, and he thinks that human beings should face up to their vagaries, and so that's what he chose to write about, the vagaries in himself, which were considerable, and in humankind very much at large.
But with the sunnier side, he's there to try to castigate almost these three real-life women in Newark, which is also quite interesting, and that also is a sort of you can't go home again, Tom Wolfe type of thing, too. But at the same time, he also... Now, this one, The Outer Edges, this book is utterly bizarre, especially The Guilt of the Dog. I mean, that whole incident, like, this protagonist is... He runs over a dog, and he's comparing himself to this true sociopath. So there's this weird impulse going along in Jackson's fiction as well. Like, on one hand, he wants to go ahead and out the truth. On another hand, he wants to basically hold everyone, including himself, accountable for every conceivable moral failing, even putting it up there with a rapist and so forth. It's a really bizarre guy.
Let me explain The Outer Edges. It is based on the Edward Haight murder case.
Yeah.
Edward Haight, when he was 16 years old, gave a lift to two kids, two girls, 11 and 9. He not only did he rape them, he tied them up, put them in the street, ran over them repeatedly, threw them. I mean, it was horrific. And Charlie was deeply disturbed by that. Now, Charlie was disturbed by the viciousness of Edward Haight because Charlie was a married father of two girls and a homosexual. And, you know, that was regarded with just... these days, people don't understand the opprobrium of in middle-class, mid-century America for gay men, especially gay men, who presume to get married and lead a normal life. And we're still, you know, seeing men on the side, as Charlie certainly was. So he did feel this kind of horrifying kinship with this child murderer, Edward Haight. So how to acceptably portray that in fiction? He comes up with a Charlie-like character who, like him, is married to a long-suffering woman and has this, and he's a doting father, as Charlie was. And he feels the kinship with the murderer in the book because he's having an affair, heterosexual,
yes.
with this Tootsie. and because he actually, and because he inadvertently runs over a dog. Now that of course is the fatal flaw with The Outer Edges. It doesn't work, and everyone told Charlie it doesn't work.
But also, there's that weird phone call heard through the gas station restroom, which makes absolutely no sense. Like, this is the reason why the wife decides to leave, because she's speculating upon a phone call. And just as he's actually more concerned about driving over the dog than this particular affair, it's he just has a really bizarre moral compass.
Yeah, well, I don't want to dismiss The Outer Edges out of hand, because certainly Charlie wrote worse books than The Outer Edges.
He looks at a secondhand life.
Oh my God. Well, let's save that. What does work in The Outer Edges is the portrayal of the murderer himself, which is really, I mean, captures this whole Hannah Arendt notion of the banality of evil in a way that I think is sort of pioneering and very effective. And it's a very episodic book. And there's the fan French, the Bovary-esque woman who's stuck in the boring marriage and tries for her maids not to see her having nothing to do. Yeah. All that was very astute. I mean, again, no less than, I'm blanking on his name, which is terrible, a great British novelist, sort of out of favor. Now, anyway, he reviewed the book in The Listener, and said, you know, Charlie Jackson is the man to write the great novel of American suburban ennui. And if he wasn't, you know, such a complete pill freak, he might have pulled it off.
Well, let's talk about this. I mean, okay, so he's an alcoholic, and he uses this to basically, first of all, write about it in The Lost Weekend. Then he becomes this big AA spokesperson.
Yeah.
But he's also this go-to guy for, like, Spencer Tracy, Robert Benchley, Dorothy Parker. He chronicles this problem, alcoholism, and as you say, at the time, this had not been pursued to this depth in fiction. And then, this is interesting, he pitches Uncle Mr. Kember to Roger Strauss, and he writes, "This book has everything. Humor, pathos, real social comment. There's the story idea that Jackson conveys to Sandy, with the wife as a shock absorber between him and the world around him." Given Jackson's keen interest in Thomas Mann, I'm wondering why he felt the need to mimic or outperform his better. I mean, the Fitzgerald passage in The Lost Weekend, where, you know, he just speaks glowingly about Fitzgerald.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you would think that, you know, Jackson could have figured out that one of Fitzgerald's fatal flaws was trying to actually reproduce Gatsby. So, you know, why was he just not self-aware enough to realize that masterpieces just kind of happened by accident?
Well, no, I mean, I think that Charlie had a taste for fine things, which was very much like Scott Fitzgerald. Scott Fitzgerald had a very big nut, you know? I mean, he liked to live lavishly, and that meant writing trashy stories for the Saturday Evening Post and not writing great novels. So there it is. Charlie, his great sort of surrogate parents in Newark was the Bloomer family, who were the richest family in town. And he wrote a story, Charlie did, called Tending Tonight.
Yeah.
About, in the midst of this dreary provincial place, here are people with real taste, who have culture, who have this opulent house. And this is something that Charlie aspired to. And then later, this man, this gay bachelor, this Wall Street lawyer with a fabulous fortune, whose father was Edith Wharton's best friend, Bronson Winthrop, takes Charlie and his brother Boom under his wing and really gives them a taste for fine things. You know, they both had tuberculosis. Bronson Winthrop sent them to these luxury sanatoria in Davos, Switzerland, and blah, blah, blah. So Charlie, you know, said, I want to live like that.
Yeah.
And he managed miraculously to get, I mean, we're condensing a lot, but he went through this period of horrific alcoholism. He miraculously got sober. He wrote The Lost Weekend, which was not only regarded critically as a masterpiece, that's the very word that the New York Times used.
I'd call it a masterpiece.
Yeah, I would too. I think that Don Burnham is still the definitive portrait of an alcoholic in American literature. And he goes to Hollywood, and suddenly he's this alcoholism guru too, as you pointed out, people like Spencer Tracy and Dorothy Parker and Benchley and so on. And, you know, he wants to keep living like that. He wants to keep still having the celebrity friends. He wants Judy Garland to remain his pal. And he buys this fabulous federal mansion in New Hampshire and finds that, you know, he can't keep it up without, you know, writing Drac.
Yeah.
And pretty soon he's doing it. He falls into the same trap that poor Fitzgerald did, which was, you know, writing terrible short stories for the Slicks.
Was it Hollywood that forced him to, I guess, have this yardstick to measure him by, or the success of The Lost Weekend? Because that sold like crazy, like Franzen style at the time, you know?
It did. It did sell like Franzen style. But what happened was, he goes to Hollywood. Everything is going Charlie's way. He's the most popular man in town. He was very endearing and very charming. Everyone invited him. You know, he never had to dine alone in Hollywood. And all the stars loved him, especially all the alcoholic stars, which was every one of them. What was the question again?
Well, I'm trying to get from you why he felt the need to be this great social novelist. And I sort of gave you a hint with Thomas Mann thing. Yeah.
Right. Charlie had a terrible need to be loved. And, you know, I mean, he adored the work of Thomas Mann. And in Mann, you know, they had sort of an Eckermann-Goethe-like relationship. Mann met him in Hollywood, and they became correspondents and kind of friends who saw each other maybe three times. It wasn't misguided for Charlie to aspire to, you know, write great books. He'd written one.
Yeah.
And to his credit, he terminated his contract at MGM. He didn't want to stay in Hollywood and be this hack. He wanted to write The Fall of Valor, which was the first mainstream novel about homosexuality in American fiction. 1946, 2 years ahead of Gore Vidal's The City and the Pillar. Problem was, it wasn't that great a novel. Now, if you want to talk about what the real reason that Charlie's fiction never equaled The Lost Weekend, we can do that.
Well, sure. Feel free. I mean, we're getting into some really high-end reading geek kind of things, but maybe we should probably explain to the people.
This is easy. Yeah, yeah. This is easy. Well, there's basically two reasons. One I've touched on, you know, that he needed money, and he needed to write Drac, and he needed to write it fast. The second reason is, the success of The Lost Weekend freaked him out.
Yeah.
I mean, Charlie, in his inmost soul, never stopped perceiving himself as this misfit from the sticks, you know, who had been the town sissy in Newark, New York. How the hell had he pulled this off? How had he won the regard of the world? And become sort of this foremost spokesman of this unknown problem hitherto known as dipsomania, now known as not a moral failing, but, you know, a clinical syndrome, alcoholism. So he, for a while, he became very famous. He became a great white hope in American literature, but he terribly insecure. And he found himself totally blocked as a writer after The Lost Weekend. Well, there was one way of getting over that writer's block, and that was Second All.
Yeah.
So he became a pill freak. And he would occasionally, he was hospitalized for overdoses, many of them deliberate, over 20 times in like 5 years. And he would occasionally manage to kick the pills, but eventually decided, you know, I'm a writer.
Yeah.
And if I'm going to write, I need to, addiction is the price I'm willing to pay.
I also wanted to bring up what Mary McCarthy attempted with Charles Jackson. I mean, she wrote a fictionalized version of him.
God, was such a coup.
Yeah. Herbert Harper in The Lost Week, which actually was unfinished. She started off as a satire about literary life, this hunt for fame. And after 50 pages, she abandons it. And she says the story becomes very, very John Marquand. Another intriguing figure who is totally overlooked. Anyway, I'm wondering, you know, what happened here? Was Jackson simply too predictable a figure for her? I mean, she did accurately predict what happened to him, that she was actually taking bits of his character as opposed to the whole subsummation of his identity into Don Burnham.
But here's what happened. I knew that Charlie admired Mary McCarthy. In The Lost Weekend, Don Burnham steals a purse that's monogrammed M-Mick, M-M-C. And that was an homage to Mary McCarthy. They met in 1945 when Charlie was struggling with his follow-up to The Lost Weekend, The Fall of Valor, while he was taking a rare vacation from his labors in Truro on Cape Cod. and Mary McCarthy had just fled her marriage to Edmund Wilson.
Yes.
And they hit it off. Again, Charlie was, but it was very much, he was the supplicant in the relationship, and she was this towering, condescending intellect. I had found this letter from Mary McCarthy to Charlie saying, I want to write a novel about your week in Truro. And Charlie was beside himself. He was ecstatic, you know, that this wonderful, one of our leading intellectuals and satirists is going to put him under the microscope. He said, leave my sex life alone. And the rest of it, you know, yeah, go to town. As long as it's not dull, I want to see what you come up with. So I thought, and she was clearly very serious about this, I thought, what happened to that novel?
Yeah.
I found a New York Times thing that she wrote, that Mary McCarthy wrote.
I found that
from
too.
The 70s. Yeah. Saying that she had gone to Nova Scotia and for a few days the novel was just going swimmingly, you know, and then it got bogged down in these dreary losers who fancied themselves writers and artists in Truro, and, you know, and they go around and they're kind of cute and John Morquandi, and they call their station wagons cute nicknames and whatnot. And she just, it wasn't the Herbert Harper / Charlie Jackson character that got her down. It was the whole ethos of Truro. It was just too dreary and nowhere, and she just didn't. So the manuscript petered out at about page 55, and I thought, where is this manuscript? And it was at Vassar with her papers. You know, she put it in a suitcase and never looked at it again. And the bits about Charlie could not be more spot on. I mean, she foresaw everything.
Yeah.
That he had basically slung his pole, put all his best material into the Lost Weekend. And from then on, you know, he was kind of dried up.
Yeah. Well, then, why then should we read the other works? I mean, you know, unlike
Cheever.
Well,
I'll tell you exactly what you should read. Yeah. You shouldn't read all of them, you, Ed, which is just superhuman. Yeah,
but unlike Cheever and Yeats, who are pretty consistent in quality, Jackson is just all over the map. Everything. But, I mean, I don't know. I found a sort of perverse thrill in reading A Secondhand Life because it was just so, it was so utterly like a man who has no idea what the national pulse is. He's trying to put his finger on the national pulse. He just doesn't get it at all. And it just is so utterly bizarre the way he describes these, you know, really pathetic sexual affairs. They're like, they're not even that interesting. It's really prosaic, you know?
Right.
But it's fascinating because he almost, and, but yet, the Shakespeare bust, which is in The Lost Weekend, is also in A Secondhand Life. So he clearly is spending his entire life trying to recapture himself as the great sort of social novelist. And how did he just become this sort of embarrassingly passe writer? I mean, why did he keep at it? Was it stubborn, persistent? Well, was it just
maybe the answer I should address here is why I wrote about Charlie Jackson. You know, Adam Kirsch, reviewing my book in the Wall Street Journal, he got it.
Yeah.
You know, he said, one way that literary biography tends to fail, I frankly don't think my literary biographies fail in this sense, is
in your humble opinion.
In my humble opinion, in conveying sort of what is the basis of a great writer's genius? How is the mess of their lives transmuted into this? What is the chemical process that turns this dross into gold, and that very few people can capture that. I again exempt myself from that. But in Charlie's case, he said, Bailey has taken an above average person who was not a genius, but longed to be a genius, and he turns it into a brilliant and gripping novelistic book, you know, because Charlie was a fascinating character, and he did write one great book. How did he do that? Okay, so why I came to this book quickly, I was going to write. I was completely fried after the Yeats and the Cheever books. You know, they're big books. And I just wanted to do this little sort of Shaggy Dog book of profiles about literary failures. You know, people who were talented, even kind of prolific. But these days, you can't even Google them. You know, they have just completely fallen off the radar. Calvin Kentfield, Nathan Ashe, Flannery Lewis, I could go on. Charlie was going to be one of those little profiles in this book because I love The Lost Weekend. I had the old Time Reading edition from 1963. I had this dog ear pen. I've read it 5 or 6 times. Okay, there's an editor's preface to that edition of The Lost Weekend, and it was published in 1963 and says Charlie Jackson finally came to admit that this was autobiographical, that he was a colossal mess like Don Burnham. He is now sober. He is the chairman of the Alcoholics Anonymous chapter in New Brunswick, New Jersey, and the doting father of 2 daughters. I thought, wow, What a redemptive fable. This is great. So I Googled Charlie and saw that he died of an overdose at Chelsea in 1968, you know, where Sid and Nancy.
Yeah.
And
well before punk, yeah.
How did he go from, and he was living with this illiterate Czechoslovakian laborer, Stanley Zednik, you know. So how did he go from this doting middle-class father in New Brunswick, sober, et cetera, to this mess who kills himself at the Chelsea living with a man in 1968? There's only 5 years there. That was the story. Got in touch with the daughters. I found out there were all these undiscovered papers at Dartmouth.
The box of letters as well, yeah.
20 boxes. He saved practically every letter he wrote as an adult. And I said, this is a mystery to be solved. And I was not disappointed. Again, Charlie's life is at the heart of so many dilemmas. What it was to be a mid-century alcoholic, to be a mid-century closeted gay man. He knew everyone. He knew everyone in the literary world. He knew everyone in Hollywood. You know, he spent time as an expatriate alcoholic in Switzerland, living the gay life, gay in the old sense. This is a fascinating story. And he made that comeback with a secondhand life.
Yeah.
It was a comeback.
But before that, he actually had this weird career in television. And he had worked in radio before. And, I mean, I really need to get this bootleg somehow. In an adaptation of Waugh's The Man Who Loved Dickens, starring Joseph Cotten, written by Jackson, and directed by Nicholas Ray.
Nicholas Ray at the height of his career. Yeah. Without a Cause and Johnny Belinda.
Yes,
That was between those two movies.
Yes. And it's only available in book. Did you actually track down a copy of this at all? Have you seen
it? I found this law scholar who described.
I found that one too, and there's also some other film geek found it.
And even he had to go to this MoMA retrospective with Nicholas Ray. It's hard to get.
Yeah, it's really hard to get. Yeah. But that also shows just how crazy television was back then. That kind of confluence.
Crazy, the kinescope
confluence
stuff. Yeah.
But it leads me to ask. I mean, you know, did television help Jackson in any way? I mean,
kept him solvent.
Yeah.
I mean, here was the fascinating thing. The first thing I looked at were 300 pages of letters at Dartmouth that had been cataloged to his brother Boom. Well, these peter out in the early 50s, right? Because Boom got fed up with Charlie and his disasters and cleaning up after them. Okay, so Charlie stopped publishing his last novel. For a long time, was The Outer Edges in 1948, and his last published book before Secondhand Life was Earthly Creatures in 1953, and then nothing. Okay, so there's 19 years between The Outer Edges and A Secondhand Life. Meanwhile, there's this book called How to Buy a Used Car by Charles R. Jackson, okay? And I thought, did he become a used car salesman? He dropped off the map. There's no evidence of what became of Charles Jackson for almost 20 years. And I wanted to find out what happened. Well, what happened was he worked in TV as a script editor for Kraft Television Theater.
Yeah.
And he was well paid for it. And in the meantime, you know, he was living this double life, as gay married men will. He had a place at the Dakota. He was a great pal of William Inge, the playwright, who was also living a double life. He went to all these gay parties and, you know, would spend weekends with his family. And it was a pill addict. It was constantly in and out of hospitals trying, you know, converted to Catholicism, was miserable the whole time, and still bouncing back until the great comeback of A Secondhand Life.
Well, I mean, I'm wondering
which
if...
Which I say tongue-in-cheek.
Yes, I know. Yeah. I'm wondering, though, if television sort of made his storytelling chops more lurid and more melodramatic in some way. I mean, okay, I disagree with you about The Outlander, because The Outlander, to me, is kind of akin to the beginning of The Fall of Valor. It's very weird because the Jackson-like hero... And in the case of The Outlander, it's about a writer who goes to this...
Benton Hargrave.
Yes, exactly. He's measuring himself up with a kind of masculinity that is military in some sense. And so I find the way that he's trying to, that the Jackson-like character in both stories is trying to present himself as cocky or more equipped than the military men. I find that to be really fascinating. And even though it's done totally melodramatically in both cases, in both The Beginning of the Fall of Valor and also The Outlander, and yet you were totally dogging on The Outlander, and I'm wondering why that is. I mean...
Yeah, I will quickly tell you. First of all, The Outlander is about 75 pages long and needs to be about 15 pages long. That's one problem. Charlie The only thing that Charlie wrote sober was The Lost Weekend, Rachel Summer, and Palm Sunday.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
Possibly The Boy Who Ran Away, but that remains a mystery. Everything else was stoned on second all. He would really hypnotize himself into thinking, wow, this is great stuff. Now, even Cheever knew. You know, if you have to start hitting the pantry and having a scoop of gin at 9:30, then you stop writing at 9:30. But you don't do both.
Yeah.
Charlie, it was he couldn't write unless he was stoned. So this is just this endlessly dilated, repetitive business. What The Outlander is about, it was about Charlie, after the hectic publication of Fall of Valor, he took a trip to Bermuda. And he started drinking again in Bermuda after a long sobriety. Of course, he had been taking pills too. But he socialized at this army base in Bermuda. And in the story, there is this wife of a pilot in Bermuda who fancies herself a writer, and she gives him a story and whatnot, and he ends up seducing her.
There's later, also the book club too, don't forget that.
All
the wives show up to actually go ahead, and it's just this total weird Charlie Jackson fantasy of him being totally adorned by all these wives of military people.
Charlie was still a famous man in those days. That, those sort of things really happened. So anyway, what happens is, he gets drunk with the husband of this woman he's seduced. And the guy admits that that when he was a pilot during World War II, they used to strafe civilians.
Yeah.
They would kill German civilians. Benton, in disgust, intimates that he has cuckolded the man.
Yeah.
And the man is left a broken man. And then we are left with the impression that Benton's going to use this as the fodder of a story. Indeed, the very story that we have just read. Now, what Charlie really wanted to do with The Outlander, as he wrote to Mary McCarthy, he wanted Benton Hargrave to sleep with both the pilot and his wife, which might have been genuinely interesting. But again, I think the story needs to be cut in half. And I do feel like we're kind of dealing on Charlie a little too much. I want to discuss what is worthwhile in Charlie's work. Can we do that?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, look.
But I will say this before you do that. I would actually argue that the sunnier side is also, I think the sunnier side is too long, and The Outlander is actually because they're both basically exploring the same aspect of writer ego from a totally different vantage point. And I think those two long-ass stories can really actually be read together to kind of get a sense of who Charlie is. And so as a result, I will defend The Outlander as the sort of the B-side to the sunnier
the
side.
B-side.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, well, first of all, Vintage has reissued two of Charlie's books to coincide with my biography. The Lost Weekend, of course, which everyone must read, not only because it's an incisive exploration of what an addict is, the inner life of an addict, but also purely on its literary merits. It is a weird and wonderful book, and the early parts of The Lost Weekend has almost this sort of Nathaniel West-esque surrealism and zaniness and black humor grading into the horror of the later as Don deteriorates. It's a terrific book. Please get The Lost Weekend and read it. The other book that was reissued is a book of short stories, The Sunnier Side. Now, I include two of Charlie's later better stories from Earthly Creatures, and so this is really kind of a collected
story. It's not actually the original Sunnier Side.
It is not. I took some stories out of the original Sunnier and put some better stories in. And
you could have crammed The Outlander in there.
Christ, no. There are three great stories in The Sunnier Side in this collection. Rachel Summer, which is based on the violent death of Charlie's sister Thelma when she was a child, when she was hit by the train, which was followed typically in Arcadia fashion by the rumor that God in his infinite wisdom, you know, sent a train to run her over because she was pregnant, and he killed her before the disgrace became obvious. That's the way those people tick. That's the way they thought. It is a tragic, wonderful story, and one of the great masterpieces about the small town mentality, as is Palm Sunday, based on Charlie's molestation by the choir master. And finally, The Boy Who Ran Away, which is a later story of Charles Jackson's. And the Charlie-like protagonist is now 48 and, you know... read The Boy Who Ran Away.
I'm in full agreement there.
It is a wonderful story. And it's one of the most self-excoriating... Charlie got himself. Charlie saw himself with terrible objectivity. Anyway, the other stories are all good and interesting. The Sunnier Side is a weird kind of... essay/story.
Ahead of postmodernism to some degree.
It is indeed. A woman had written Charlie saying, you know, I read this story in Good Housekeeping that you wrote, and I'm so glad that for once you wrote about a wholesome subject and you're not writing about drunks and sex maniacs and so on. And she said, I too am from Newark, and I knew these women who were the most popular girls in town, and so on. Well, Charlie thought that was kind of ironic because the three women who were the most popular girls in town all went on to lead lives of promiscuity, alcoholism, all these things that this woman is congratulating him for avoiding. So he wrote back to her saying, you know, wrote back to her this sort of fascinating disquisition on the nature of art versus reality.
Yeah.
And, you know... Talking about it's very complicated. Would you like to sort of shed some light on The Sunnier Side?
It's called. I think it just needs to be read. But
it's almost like John Barth or Borges or Nabokov. It's a funhouse mirror. You know, I mean, he says that first of all, take this one woman. Who's based on a woman from Newark called Edith Warren. She was the golden girl in town. She went to Smith. She was valedictorian. She came home. She married the It Boy. He was the president of the Rotary Club and blah, blah, blah. Turned out he was a terrible philanderer. She had to quit all her clubs. Her house went up in flames, and the police found, you know, three corpses, the Edith, her husband, and their child, all with bullets in them.
And
concluded that someone in the family shot, you know, all the other ones and then set the place on fire.
Yeah.
So he said, you know, this wasn't exactly, you know, a golden life after all. So what do you want me to do? Do you want me to write life, you know, as if it is this this sunshiny business, or write life as it is? And even now, though, it's too complicated. Off the cuff, I can't do justice to The Sunnier Side because there's all sorts of this meta stuff going on.
I wanted to also go back to what you were touching upon based off of the Adam Kirsch review of your book about what literary biography should do and can do.
Right.
It seems to me that one thing your biographies really do very well are dredging up these unexpected cultural items. I had mentioned the G.E. True Theater adaptation of Waugh that he did, but also I discovered through your book, The Author Meets the Critics, this bizarre radio program, which, by the way, I managed to find online and put onto Internet Archive, and I will link to it in the show notes.
That's great, Ed.
And I listened to a few of them, and they're just really incredible. I mean, you know, it seems to me that exposing how something like that can actually make it on the air and last for as many years as it did,
right,
is also one of the, I think, responsibilities of the biographer, who's also in some sense a historian. And I'm wondering, you know, is this something of an MO in both, you know, looking at one person's life or what? How does this work?
Well, I mean, the funny thing in Charlie's case is he went on The Author Meets the Critics, and basically the critics are supposed to be very aggressive and make the author stand up and defend his work. And he was on with a literary critic and this psychotherapist, Gregory Zilborg, who you can Google. I think there's a Wikipedia entry for him. Anyway, Charlie was appalled because he thought the psychotherapist was a charlatan, and he was bringing all this specious psychoanalytical jargon, you know, to bear on criticizing The Lost Weekend. So Charlie said, you know, I'll never do that damn stupid Author Meets the Critics thing again.
Of course.
Well, he was persuaded to come back a second time. And that time went better for Charlie. So he did it a third time, thus becoming the record holder for most author appearances in behalf of the same book.
Yeah.
And he said, for Fall of Valor, I think you need to do it at least three times again, because there's so many piquant social issues that are broached in this book. So he became this great advocate for The Author Meets the Critics, yeah. having been, you know, having deplored it.
But it was a really weird power balance, because the author was the only person who could defend the book.
Right.
And what's also fascinating, I mean, it reminds me of when we last talked, we were talking about Dwight MacDonald's By Cousins Possessed, and how that essentially killed Cousins' career.
Destroyed him not only, I mean, Cousins was in the catbird seat. He had written By Love Possessed. It was the far and away the favorite to win the Pulitzer and the National Book Award. Dwight MacDonald comes along and writes By Cousins Possessed in commentary, and it is nuclear.
Yeah.
Nuclear. And brilliant.
Yeah.
And not only did it... instead, A.G., who MacDonald championed, won for... what's A.G.'s?
Death in the Family.
Death in the Family. And Cheever won for the Wapshot Chronicle, the National Book Award. And Cousins is forgotten.
Yes.
He is forgotten. And the reason for that is MacDonald absolutely blew him, I mean, methodically out of the water.
Well, the question is how were critics able to have such power then? I mean, it seems inconceivable now.
Well,
we don't
have
really have book review
sections. MacDonald's brilliance, for one thing. And he absolutely was spot on in every, I mean, all the pretensions and the horrible, you know, this was mid-cult stuff that Dwight MacDonald deplored. The pretension, the borrowings from serious literature, you know, and the sheer sort of turbid unreadability of Cousins. He's a terrible writer.
But he's great if you want to build your vocabulary.
There you go. Yeah. Exactly. Yes. As far as the power of critics and The Author Meets Critics, I wish that show existed today. I would like to go on that show with Jonathan Yardley, and I would take that senile douchebag apart absolutely limb by limb.
Do you know, I found his I talked to Norman Rush, and I found his review of Mating. And he called it just, I don't see why anybody would ever want to read this. It was really amazing, like, you know, that he basically suggested that Norman Rush should be a flash.
I didn't go there.
I mean, did the critics have any real power?
I bet Yardley likes James Gould Cousins. That's precisely the sort of thing he likes. And
he also likes Marquand as well.
Championed the rediscovery of Marquand, exactly.
Which I also tried to write about. I wrote about, too. And I think he's actually an interesting...
Absolutely. Yeah. The late, great George Appling is really good.
Yes. Yeah. And also, Sincerely, Willis Wade is really a bitter novel. And also, So Little Time is one of the best...
So Little Time is
It's
good.
One of the best novels depicting America during World War II, right before they were about to get involved. It's fantastic.
I quite agree.
Yes. I was going to try to find a transition before we got off of several tangents here about how critics actually affected Charlie's career. I mean, you know, it seems to me that they
didn't. Well, for better and for worse.
Well, but I mean, it seems to me they tolerated him far more than they should have. You know, it seems to me like Roger Strauss was more of a hard ass on Jackson than any of the critics. Everyone wanted him to come
Roger
up with another
Roger Strauss subsidized Charlie for a long time before cutting him loose. You know, everyone, again, The Lost Weekend is a great, great book and needs to be reestablished in the canon of great American literature. Some of Charlie's stories are pioneering. Nobody, I repeat, nobody was writing about this stuff, was writing about addiction, alcoholism, homosexuality, pederasty, for God's sake, child murders. You know, I mean, this was Charlie sort of bringing this into the popular discourse. He deserves cred for that, totally. Nymphomania. But, as far as the critics were concerned, the critics rightfully took Charlie very seriously. Again, Philip Wiley, talk about a forgotten writer who was a big deal in his time, he wrote the New York Times Book Review notice for The Lost Weekend and said, the greatest contribution to the literature of addiction since De Quincey, this is a masterpiece of psychological precision. Well, there's a funny sequel to that. Wiley, you know, was saying, Charlie, you're the great white hope. They became friends, and Charlie was friends with Philip Wiley's brother Max, and said, you know, write a sequel to The Lost Weekend, and because this is you're on a tear here. And Charlie said, no, I want to write this homosexual novel of Fall of Valor. And Wiley says, it doesn't matter. You're a genius. Whatever you do is going to be great. So then Charlie sends out, you know, drafts of the Fall of Valor to his various friends, including Philip Wiley. And I found among Philip Wiley's papers at Princeton, like, four drafts of this letter in which he tries to respond to the Fall of Valor. He is flabbergasted and appalled. He cannot believe that the author of The Lost Weekend has written this terrible novel. And he's trying to find some way. But every time, you know, Philip Wiley was this very caustic, satirical writer. And every time he lapses into this sort of just scalding derision, so he, you know, puts it aside and he starts over again. And he saved these letters, the drafts that he didn't send Charlie, for posterity and put them among his papers at Princeton. So I examine in my thing, you know, how he grappled with trying to respond to this poor guy and set him back on the right course as a writer. But, you know, it's hard to write when you're stoned on pills all the time. I mean, your brain is mush.
But so, it's fascinating to me because on one hand, the critics back then had more power. But if you wrote something as trailblazing as The Lost Weekend, they would give you far more passes than a lot of other writers. It's really interesting that there's that kind of... Today, I don't think people would get that kind of pass.
Oh, no. Absolutely not. No, absolutely not. Again, you know, I mean, it was a far more bookish culture. And that was sort of what Dwight MacDonald was railing against, was that they were trying to sort of... transport high culture, serious writing, to the masses. And the corruption involved in that process produced people like John Gould Cousins and, as MacDonald would have it, Mark Wand and that ilk, people who were mistakenly taken seriously as high cultural writers and weren't. You know, that they were it was dreck.
And now Daniel Mendelsohn is trying to pick up that torch unsuccessfully, I think.
Interesting. Yeah. I read well.
Like his attempted takedown of Mad Men, which I don't think really got into.
That's ridiculous. So, Mad Men doesn't. Mad Men is wonderful popular entertainment, and you've got to make that distinction. And that's what I tell my students. You know, by all means, indulge in guilty pleasures, but know that you're indulging in guilty pleasures. I mean, I watch Mad Men religiously, and I'm pissed when I miss it. Okay, I look forward to it. Anyway, no, I mean, again, Charlie, it's an interesting case. Your first novel is a classic. It has enormous sociocultural impact. It's the first serious novel about alcoholism. Everyone is watching your career. You're totally freaked out by it. You write a pioneering novel about homosexuality. It's not abysmally bad. I know a lot of gay men of that generation who thought this is the first novel that really told it like it is. Its literary merits are dubious, but it's not horrible. Meanwhile, he keeps writing interesting things. Occasionally, he kind of knocks a ball out of the park. He writes these good stories. Outer Edges is an interesting book. It has its moments, by all means. And then he falls silent. He falls silent because he's overwhelmed by addiction, by self-loathing. He's in and out of mental hospitals, you know. And then he makes his great comeback with The Secondhand Life.
Yeah. I do not want to make the mistake of not mentioning Rhoda, as we have not mentioned Rhoda.
Rhoda.
And I think we should deal in part with what she did to tolerate this remarkable behavior for so long, and also maybe how the money was managed. Unlike the other books, it seems a little bit more mysterious in Jackson's case. You know, how were they able to, like, just spend so much money, and how was able to, I mean, I suppose that a compulsive person like Charlie would be resourceful enough to find the money for the second all or whatnot.
Well, that was what the terrible stories for the Slicks were all about. I mean, they lived in that huge federal mansion, Six Chimney Farm, on the Connecticut River in Orford, New Hampshire, for 10 years. They could only afford it for about the first 4 years. And then everything turned to shit, you know?
Yeah.
But occasionally he'd sell a story. He got top dollar. I mean, he got Fitzgerald-like money for his short stories. So he was kind of able to pay the grocer and sort of temporize and whatnot. And then he wasn't anymore. And it was horrible. I mean, he had so many creditors in that town. They practically gathered, you know, with pitchfork and torches on his lawn. But everyone loved Rhoda. Rhoda Booth, his wife, was a researcher at Fortune magazine. She
where Jack McDonald got his start too.
She was a friend of Cousins.
Yes.
Cousins was a friend of both Jacksons. She worked for Cousins at Fortune. She worked for Archibald MacLeish. MacLeish wrote in this sort of oral autobiography, said, "She's the best researcher I ever had. You know, she's a person of a wonderful sort of scrupulosity and intelligence." So here is this person. She was a Vermont Scot. She was the temperamental opposite of Charlie. Charlie was this volatile, charming, almost manic raconteur. Manic, literally. He was almost certainly bipolar. And here was this person with a total flat affect, practical, literal-minded, and so on. So either the most perfect possible mate for Charlie or the worst possible mate. They had virtually no sex life after they had those two daughters. And everyone wondered, does Rhoda know? Does she know, you know, that Charlie sleeps with men? Yes, the answer is yes. And, you know, I mean, I interviewed Ron Sproat. He's now dead. He's the one who came up with Barnabas Collins.
Yes.
You know, Dark Shadows. Wonderful guy. And Charlie was always hitting on him at the Dakota because he was an intern at Kraft TV Theater. And Ron Sproat was taken to dinner at Charlie's house. And he thought, oh, my God, Rhoda, his wife, is going to think that I'm Charlie's boy and whatnot. Rhoda couldn't have been more kind and civil. And later, Ron asked Charlie, said, wow, your wife's awfully nice to me, you know. And he said, oh, well, she, you know, she knows. She knows.
Yeah.
He told her everything. And after he was dead, after he left her to move into the Chelsea, resume taking pills, finish his novel about a nymphomaniac, and finally come out of the closet, rather triumphantly, I might add, and live with his Czechoslovakian boyfriend, Stanley, you know, and finally died of the inevitable overdose, the daughters asked Rhoda, said, you know, do you have any regrets? And this is years later. She lived for 25 years after Charlie's death. And she said, no, the best thing that ever happened to me was your father.
Yeah.
And boom, the same. You know, the brother who had to join forces with Rhoda to keep him alive and to clean up his messes. Both of them said, Charlie was the best thing that ever happened to us.
Were you able to find anything about Rhoda's thoughts on the way the wives were portrayed in Charlie's fiction? Because they start off being these extremely tolerant people, and then all of a sudden they either leave or they revolt. But it's this constant, you know, buildup, and this is often one of the kind of weird narrative arcs, especially in the post Lost Weekend stuff. I mean,
right.
Given how he was mining so heavily from his life, I'm wondering if Rhoda had any thoughts on, you know, that's not cool. You're actually using me in your fiction, right?
No, I think Rhoda sort of took that stuff with a grain of salt. First of all, she appears as Helen.
Yes.
In, you know, and he pisses himself and she takes his pants off and puts him in a bath. That was Rhoda's life throughout, you know, Charlie's early alcoholism. She wouldn't marry him because she knew that he was pretty much hopeless, but she took care of him and she was just the epitome of the long-suffering mate. So there's nothing to object to in that. But you mentioned the post. Ethel Grandin, again, what makes The Fall of Valor a bad novel is that the characters are more or less objective creations. John Grandin, except for his tortured bisexuality, is not Charlie. He has none of Charlie's charm. He has none of Charlie's erudition. He's a boring, dry-as-dust university professor and a prig. And his wife, Ethel, is a totally cardboard construction. So I don't think Rhoda really saw any correspondences
there. As is the Marine's wife,
now,
too.
I think, as is the Marine's wife. The Outer Edges, you know, that's Charlie and that's Rhoda, essentially. But I think the wife is sympathetic. You know, she sticks with him and
until she
like
listens to the gas station phone call.
Yeah, but the implication is that, you know, she's going to persevere.
Yeah.
And that was Rhoda. She hung in there through thick and thin. She was loyalty personified.
I was not able to make it to your event with DT Max last night, in large part because I was on cookie baking duty for my partner's.
Cookie baking duty?
I had to bake cookies.
That's much more important.
Yeah, so I've been making the cookies for all of her events. That's
right.
What I do. I wasn't able to make it, but One of my issues with Every Love Story is a Ghost Story by D.T. Max is that he seemed to be angling for motive about David Foster Wallace without really making these plausible connections. In your case, you always double source it. You always make sure it absolutely relates to writing motive, creating motive, and to a lesser extent, living motive. You know, and then of course, Mary Carr replied on Twitter, "As for my seeking him, DFW had two major suicidal attempts before I met him. He came crazy. I didn't make him that way."
Right, right.
Obviously, you had also more time with Jackson than Max had with DFW, but this does raise a number of literary biography questions, which I'm hoping to ask you. As a literary biographer, how do you avoid this scenario of not becoming the sort of sleazy Paul Bryant-like character from Alan Hollinghorst's *The Stranger's Child*, which I'm sure you've read that.
No, I mean, I listened to your podcast with Alan Hollinghorst.
Oh, yeah. Oh, he's an amazing.
And
guy.
And believe me, everyone said you've got to see this schlocky literary biographer in that book. And so that's what I know about. I know your interview with Alan Hollinghorst, so I need to. Sorry, I need to read that.
But I mean. Anyway, so long series of questions. One, how do you avoid becoming that type? And two, you're now working, of course, on the Philip Roth biography. Now you're dealing with people who are still alive and who are on Twitter. So, you know, what do you do to ensure that people don't come at you with the knives and pitchforks as you're making these discoveries and all that? And
well,
how do you build
sleeves? First of all, in D.T. Max's defense, you know, I think that he treats Wallace with a great deal of objectivity and understanding, and I don't think that he makes any great leaps and or misrepresents things. He's very scrupulous. I do have misgivings with Dan's book. One thing is the legend, this almost secular saint like figure that Wallace became. This wise, kind person who delivered the commencement address at Kenyon, which may be the way, God help us, posterity most remembers him for, this is water. And he says, you know, we must be aware of others. We must avoid the solipsistic trap of our human nature. Don't get trapped in your own head. Well, of course, that was precisely Wallace's dilemma.
Yeah.
He could not have killed himself in a more brutal, callous, insensitive way. Karen Green, his wife, had been on police watch to keep him alive for weeks. She would not leave the house.
Have you read her memoir yet?
Not yet. Oh, yeah. She has a memoir?
She did. She came out with a small press. Blanking on the name. I haven't read it yet, but it's supposed to be really amazing. It's like one of the best portraits of grief, apparently, that has come out.
So Wallace hangs himself in the most conspicuous, just egregiously callous way, and puts his manuscript there with a bunch of lamps trained on it. So, you know, take care of this, honey. Meanwhile, so long. Totally belies the secular saint-like image. And, you know, if you've read, like, the story Good Old Neon in his last collection, Oblivion, you have a person who is entombed in this self-consciousness, who he knows on a basic level is motivated by meanness, by pettiness, competitiveness, by a need to be the smartest guy in the room, who can hardly open his mouth without a feeling of self-loathing over his own duplicity and so forth. That was Wallace. And that's a very human dilemma. You know, I mean, we tend to... Like, I'm a tennis fan. I love Federer. I love Bjorn Borg because they're my temperamental opposite. I have this D-minus temperament. And those guys, they've got it under control. I want to be like them. We tend to like people who are not like ourselves. Wallace wanted to be the opposite of what he knew himself to be. Okay? And finally, he lost that battle. And that's embodied in the horrible way he killed himself. That's where Max's book ends.
Yeah.
This is not the way people would have chosen for David Foster Wallace, but that was the way he chose. You know, something to that effect, that's the end. There's no epilogue. There's no talk about the hideous psychological fallout for Karen, for people who loved him. And what about the larger culture, people who hero worship David Foster Wallace? I mean, who wanted some explanation, and they're left with this?
Yeah.
And also, what is his literature? What is going to be his literary reputation? Is going to be remembered for the fiction? You know, like Salinger, who's certainly in the news right now, he was kind of disappearing up his own alimentary canal. Yeah. Those stories in Oblivion are virtually unreadable. They're so convoluted and diffuse. And it's like Salinger's last, like Seymour in Introduction in Hapworth 16, 1924. I mean, it's becoming incredibly sort of narcissistic and unreadable. So what is he going to be remembered for? Are people going to still be reading Infinite Jest? That's no picnic either. I loved it.
Yeah.
But it was before he started, you know, becoming more and more like that. Or are they going to remember him as this nonfiction? And what about what we know of his life now? The saintly or, you know, I mean, very sympathetic person who wrote that nonfiction, does that translate? And, you know, anyway, long story short, Dan doesn't really address this issue of posterity, and I think he should have.
Well, but in his defense, he had this deadline to get the book out, and now...
Well, we all have deadlines.
But the thing is his deadline coincided with all of the, you know, what I have joked, you know, as the DFW death porn industry. Let's pump out every single form of writing that is still left, and whether it's good or great or not, or bad, we will put it out in book form, and it's still ongoing. So... And of course, with Salinger, which, yes, that's a very good example, that is just as beholden to commercial needs of, we have a film and we have a big book.
Oh, the big revelation. And the big revelation is going to, all this posthumous work's going to come out. It's going to be terrible.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. And Salinger is suffering the exact same problem as DFW.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. So with these kind of commercial constraints affecting the literary biographer, I mean, how does it, how can you guys avoid this?
I have to repeat, though I... You know, I had these misgivings about the need for an epilogue, the need to examine how the world reacted, never mind how Karen Green reacted to David's death. You know, I think Dan's book is terrific. It's readable. It is incredibly smart. And you know, it's a great job. So I'm not meaning to knock it.
I understand.
He was striking when the iron is hot, and he wouldn't deny that.
Yeah, yeah.
That he had a deadline, and it's not at all shocky. I mean, he took enough time that was needed to get the goods. It's well researched, and he wasn't seeking to do a comprehensive work.
Yeah, but shouldn't a biographer wait like 5 or 10 years before an author passes
to get a sense of? Yeah,
I mean, you may very well face what is the
posthumous reputation?
Yeah. But you're actually in the hot seat with the Roth bio, I would argue, because you know, he's obviously going to die fairly soon, and you may actually also be beholden to the Philip Roth death industry that crops up. I mean, you know, are you taking any safeguards right now to make sure?
I always take a safeguard. Philip and I have signed a collaboration agreement.
Yes.
It's the same one that I signed with the Cheevers. He can vet my work, or he or his estate can vet the work for factual accuracy, but they cannot alter interpretive stuff. You know, my examination of motive and inner life and whatnot. So I feel well covered, and Philip has been a dream to work with. He's very helpful. He's given me all his private papers, stuff that's going to remain under seal to the public till 2050 at the Library of Congress.
Wow.
I have stacked up in my office, and I can use as I see fit in my biography. And he's a hilarious, very likable guy. So we've been getting along great. And he's not intruding. He is telling people to be totally candid with me. And he himself is hair-raisingly candid.
Have you had any problems getting people to talk because Philip Roth is still alive?
Claire Bloom?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, she's you know, she consented to answer some email questions, but she did so rather tersely, except for one question, but I'm not going to give that away. She said, you know, her position is she has said everything she had to say in that memoir. Philip, I think, would point out, rightly so, that the memoir, to put it mildly, is biased and egregiously inaccurate.
Going back, though, to the query that you have skillfully evaded, I want to actually ask again how an esteemed literary biographer who has done, I think, first-rate work on Cheever, on Yeats, and now on Jackson, I mean... How do you avoid the problem of the Philip Roth death industry? How do you actually go ahead and continue with the sort of classy, thorough, rigorous biography when you know that the minute Philip Roth drops dead, everyone is going to go ahead and rush out books. There's going to be more collections, etc. The Library of America volumes will be continue and all that. Yeah.
First of all, I myself hope that Philip hangs in there,
yeah.
And he may well do that. But, you know, Philip is retired. He's not writing anymore.
Yeah.
He hasn't been writing
except for Wikipedia New Yorker articles.
Right. Right. He hasn't been writing fiction since 2009, and he's not going to write any more fiction. He's done. So that's 4 years. I'm going to take at least 7 or 8 more years to squeeze out what may be the first volume of a two-volume biography. By then, it will have been 11 or 12 years since his last book was published. We will have a sense of how posterity is viewing Philip's work. And he has now, the Library of America edition is complete in 9 volumes. So I think that I will have a certain perspective on that. Will I fully satisfy the requirement of, you know, precising how posterity has decisively come down on the issue of Philip Roth? Maybe not, but I think that I'll be able to adequately address that problem.
Okay. So I happen to have read your memoir, which is coming out next year, The Splendid Things We Planned, which I managed to get through the good people at Norton. What is interesting about this book, and we won't talk about it too much, maybe we'll talk about it later, but
in
a third appearance or whatever,
yeah.
But this book isn't so much about you. It's about your brother, Scott.
Mm-hmm.
And it was also extremely odd to read a Blake Bailey book with Blake Bailey as one of the characters that also was not heavily sourced. I mean, there's no notes. It's a memoir format.
It's a memoir. It's subjective. It's entirely different mode.
But a
tough one for me.
Yeah, but I realize that. But I have to ask, there were a few parts of this memoir. The acrimonious relationship with your stepmother over the brick path. The trouble you had with your vice principal brother, Howie, where you didn't entirely point out to how your own personality may have actually contributed to these particular conflicts. And I'm wondering, you know, did you try tracking down Brother Howie to get his side of the story? I mean, did you...
Brother Howie's side of the story is not the point. Again, I mean, memoirs are inherently subjective. It's how I perceive Scott and Howie and my step monster, and how we all as a family survived the Armageddon of having a person like Scott in the immediate family. Everyone tells me, I don't know about you, Ed, I'm certainly interested to hear. Everyone tells me that I'm very hard on myself in this book. I mean, I'm kind of this fuck up and loser, which I was. And you know, who skirted with alcoholism, and so forth. So I don't think I go easy on myself. I point out the fact, these are the very words, that I was lazy and self-involved, and that got my step monster's goat. I don't think I really, I don't think I really let myself off the hook. In fact, again, some of my friends who have read this say, you know, a major problem with this is that you don't give the whole picture. You weren't this total loser and failure up to a certain point in your life. You know, you had redeeming qualities. And I said, well, that's the story I chose to tell. So
I guess because you're placing yourself, obviously, as the hero of your own story, even though you do point out, yes, that you went through a fifth every 3 days or whatnot.
I'm not the hero of the story, but I'm the point of view character.
Yeah. Well, you're the point of view character, but because you were writing about yourself, I mean, you know, how can you be sufficiently critical, or is this just something you just take? You knew it was going to be a memoir format. You knew it wasn't going to be a sort of rigorous investigation. It was just, I mean, at least on a sort of factual basis and on a sort of what you've done with the previous books, it's certainly a rigorous emotional investigation. But, you know, I mean, what do you do to I guess, switch horses like this to really
be
fair?
It was brutal. I write in my acknowledgments that I worked on this for about 11 years.
Yeah, I know that.
And, you know, as my editors will tell you on my 3 literary biographies, which are cinder blocks, the published work was very close to the submitted manuscript. I mean, only very light editing was required. That is a genre that comes more easily to me. There's nothing easy about researching and writing literary biographies. But, you know, to see a life objectively, to know what matters, to know which themes, you know, predominate over others and so on, is very easy for me to put that in a comprehensible narrative structure. Subjectivity is a great muddler, okay? Again and again, the editor would say, we need more emphasis on this to balance. We cannot have this relentless, downer stuff about your crazy brother. What about your father?
Yeah.
What about your mother? What about you? You know, and so I was constantly rejiggering it, constantly adding stuff, taking stuff out, working with the structure. I mean, I don't know whether this succeeds or not, frankly. I think it's a pretty jumpy, I think it's a pretty breezy read, but and it's short. It has the virtue of being short. All I know is I gave it my best shot.
Yeah. But, I mean, you know, it is interesting that Blake in this book, actually, he's very prominent in probably the first part, and then he just gradually disappears as Scott actually becomes more of a character, I guess. And I'm wondering about that. I mean, it's like, you're inevitably going to have some introspection, but, I don't know. I mean, are you terrified of examining yourself or, you're certainly comfortable with yourself. That's without question, but, you know.
No, there is I think that I'm pretty hard on myself, but I wasn't the whole point here. I mean, the whole point was, how did my father come out of this? How did my mother eventually cope with this? It culminates in that climactic Christmas where, I mean, Scott is totally unbalanced.
And without giving it away, there are very hard decisions that are made. Yeah.
Yes. And we go out and we buy a gun and we sick the police on him. And I like to think it's highly dramatic, but also kind of funny. After that, Scott spends a lot of time in prison, so he is sort of off stage, and we simply talk about the aftermath, the fallout in all of our lives. How did we gain equilibrium after the Holocaust of Scott? So, you know, again, I don't think he takes over the story. I mean, you're a more objective reader than I am. But,
I mean to suggest he takes over the story, but that as you start to wane in the story,
right,
he starts to rise, and then you kind of come back near
then
the
I
end.
Then I come back, yeah. I wanted to discuss the fact that I was a lot like Scott.
Yeah.
Both for better and for worse, we have a very similar sense of humor. There are
your
things.
Your family's terrible with cars, by the way.
Terrible with cars. Yeah. The cover is a flaming, flaming car. Scott cracked up cars. I cracked up cars. I write there at the very end of the book that after Scott died, I never dreamed about him ever, which was always very strange, and neither did my mother, who had this very odd symbiotic relationship with Scott. But whenever I would laugh at something sort of odd that no one else would laugh at, Scott would occur to me, because I know that Scott would have laughed at it too. I mean, we were very much on the same wavelength, and we were both self-destructive. But Scott, you know, was the New York Yankees to my, you know, single A farm team in that respect. And eventually, I met this person who, you know, was on a more even keel than I was, and who did appreciate my finer qualities, and that made all the difference. And so my life, which had been sort of following this ominous tangent, became what I am today, our most beloved literary biographer. I'm kidding, of course. But whereas Scott went down the toilet, where he was arguably always destined to go. But I might have gone there too. But this is a lie. This is a story about the odd things that happen in lives that save us and make us go in a different direction.
Blake, you have another appointment, and I want to make sure you make it. It has been a pleasure to chat with you. We will probably do this again, but thank you very much, and this has been a long chat.
I think
we got a lot in here.
Okay. Thank you, Ed. Friday night, everything's right for the weekend. Crazy clothes, anything goes on the weekend. John called Ed and Jim got sued. I made a date with little old you. Off we went to make a big deal.